You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I'm joined by Michael Norton, Chief Creative Officer, and today we have Matthew Dean joining us again to talk mainly about Ghostbusters, but potentially other things. Hey, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. That was a fruitful discussion last time.
Yes, much fruit.
Much fruit to be had.
Full of fruit.
An entire orchard.
Well, I was thinking before we can jump into to Ghostbusters, Michael, is there anything, any other breaking news, something you wanted to get off your chest before we get into that? Because the Ghostbusters thing is going to take up the majority of our hour.
Well, not a lot happened this week. I mean, Apple sent out their invites and people are, of course, pouring it over it like the Zapruder film as always.
Invites for what?
The new event on the 21st.
Some new products.
I don't know anything about this. What is the rumored event?
The long rumored event is where they will announce the 4-inch iPhone.
And a touchscreen MacBook, right, Michael?
No.
No?
No.
I have looked.
That's right. That's what we talked about last time.
I have looked into the flames. They have revealed to me what Apple will show.
The flames were lies.
So yes, the 4-inch iPhone, the iPhone SE will be announced, as well as the 9.7-inch iPad Pro with smart keyboard and Apple Pencil support.
And are they going to say, okay, we finally admit that we overplayed how important we thought watches were going to be?
No, they're going to announce several new bands for the watch, including new sport band options, a new NATO nylon band, and possibly more Hermes bands.
Just bands? You don't think there's going to be any?
Yeah, no, there's no Apple Watch 2 yet. That'll be in the fall.
The fall, right. Okay, that makes sense.
They're still trying to convince us that watches are a thing.
Oh, they're a thing.
They're a thing.
They're just not a thing for everyone yet, but soon they will be.
That's exactly right.
Another two or three revisions, then you'll want one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure that's true.
You'll want one.
Well, I think once we get a smartwatch with wireless charging, that will be sweet.
You mean like what it already does?
No.
It already does.
It doesn't plug in.
It just goes on the pad.
But it's got, but it's got that magnetic clasp, right, where it just kind of...
Yeah, but that's to keep it sitting on the thing.
Right, okay.
It's still wireless, though.
I did not know that.
Well, like,
right, of course, because it doesn't
this
have
is
a
waterproof.
Right,
so,
it doesn't have
like,
a lightning port.
Where's
on
the
it?
Port? Right,
right.
I think watches will become a thing when it requires no phone.
Yes, that will certainly be a thing.
That's gonna be a while though.
But the primary thing, and this is what Apple has hired hundreds of people to work on, health. This is going to be the big thing that drives the watch. Adding new health sensors and finding new ways to track a person's vital status.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like what sensors are you thinking?
Well, the current heart rate sensor already is technically an oximeter.
Okay.
They just have to turn that on.
What's an oximeter?
It tracks blood oxygen levels.
Oh, okay.
Then they have the expert in non-invasive glucose sensors. So a sensor that can literally sit on your skin and go, this is what your blood sugar is, without needing to prick your finger or get blood or anything. The problem before they hired the person was that it was a margin less accurate than the existing glucose readers. But no doubt Apple will have thrown hundreds of millions of dollars of their R&D budget towards making it accurate.
But even if it's a margin... of error, I mean, it's still quite useful.
True,
to a lot of diabetics.
For diabetics, it's important to know exactly what the level is, because if it's off by
it depends on the margin of error.
Yeah, it depends. So I think their goal is to get it to within that margin of error where they can comfortably announce it and be like, this will warn you if your blood sugar is too high or too low.
Okay. Well, then at that point, it's an important piece of machinery.
Yes.
I will admit it at that point.
Then there are other sensors they can add, such as galvanic skin response for stress levels. They can increase the battery power to enable sleep tracking.
Mm-hmm. I would love the sleep tracking thing.
And who knows what else? Like, that's just the starting point. From
the sleep tracking stuff has been... I don't want to say a gimmick, that's a bit disingenuous, but there have been tons of apps that do sleep tracking where you have to have your phone under your pillow all night plugged into power. So it's a bit of a...
Or the Bedit, which you put this strip thing.
But that's definitely an increasingly important thing to know for sure.
Yeah. I think sleep quality is definitely something that is really important, especially in our society where people are getting less sleep and working long hours and...
But the thing about watch technology and Apple really attacking health, I mean, health is not really a matter of technology at this point. I mean, that's not helping you get outside or be more active.
It's not, but I think building a device where simply by wearing it, you get a large idea of where your health is, where your current status is without needing to go to a hospital, without needing to go to a doctor, something that can warn you if, oh, hey, this doesn't look good. You should talk to someone about this, like that kind of thing. I mean,
so it's good. So it's good for health maintenance. It's not going to necessarily improve your health. It's going to.
No, like it's gonna not going to kick your ass if you don't get out the door and go on a run. No.
Yeah, but I would actually argue that that the technology is important and does help you, because the there have been countless cases where people have said that they've lost weight by wearing the Apple Watch, because it reminds you to stand up and go and stretch, and also reminds you to go for walks. So as long as you're actually doing the things that it's actually nudging you to do, then the technology is helping.
Yeah, I mean, the UI does try to gently remind you to...
Right.
Exercise more, and if you listen to it, then
I think it uses the haptic feedback too to kind of buzz and say,
it gives
you
notifications about it.
Like, it tells you to get up and go for a walk.
Yeah,
yeah.
Part of the native OS.
Yeah, it's built into it.
It's built into the entire system. So at 50 minutes past the hour, if you haven't stood for those 50 minutes, it will buzz and tell you, hey, you should stand up and walk around.
Well, the most famous case I think that I can remember is Jim Dalrymple from the Loop, the Loop website, who lost, I think, more than 50 pounds just by wearing the Apple Watch. He did exactly what it told him to do, and he lost a lot of weight.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean...
Well, sitting is the new smoking.
Well, yeah, exactly.
That's interesting, because I do sometimes
tomorrow,
have a habit
tomorrow Matt will be coming on with an Apple Watch.
After I just said there was no point, and then I'm going to buy
Apple Watch Sport. Yep. So it tracks three metrics throughout the day. It tracks...
He's such a good at a sales pitch for Apple products.
hey, Matt, when is Crunch 3 coming out for Apple Watch?
Well... First, he has to sell it to me.
Yeah. So it tracks three metrics. The inner blue ring is how many hours you've stood. It asks that you stand at least 12 hours a day. Then there's the exercise ring, which is 30 minutes a day. And the move ring, which changes it's a caloric count, like how many calories you burned throughout the day. And that can change depending on how well you've done during the week. So at the end of every week, you get a summary. And if you met your goal or surpassed it a lot, it'll raise that goal and try to get you to do better next week.
So they really, I mean, they designed it as a health utility.
Yes.
I mean, that's the way it sounds. I mean, I always just thought it was, let's find clever little wrist apps.
And I think what is the integration that they did? They worked directly with the Mayo Clinic. To do some kind of
integration? That's a research kit.
Research kit, okay.
And research kit combined with the existing health kit APIs allows researchers to create apps that will test various things for patients. So they can create apps in trial studies. They give people iPhones or Apple Watches, and it tracks all of their health data. And they input, like, here's what this was at this time. And it all funnels back to them through the cloud, so they can instantly get a ton of test data for a trial.
And does that also imply, since it's through an API, that this research data will be in a format where it's interoperable with other research data?
Yes. Research Kit is open sourced.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, they took quite a lot of time out of one of their more recent keynotes. I think it was the 6S keynote or maybe WWDC last year. They spent about 10 or 15 minutes talking about it and how important it was. And they brought several doctors up on stage to talk about the test study apps that they had built with ResearchKit and what it was able to do for them. One, I think it was through the Mayo Clinic, they were able to track allergy data from like 10,000 people in real time, like every day, what are your symptoms? And then they were able to combine that with allergy map data, like here's where all the pollen is and here's all this other stuff. And they were able to get-
So it's like Google Maps with actual car traffic.
Yeah. And they were able to get all of those results in real time as people were inputting everything.
This was the dream that I think Tim Berners-Lee had at one point when he was basically asked about what the next evolution of the web was, and he was talking about interoperability of data.
Yeah.
And on the web level, we haven't really gotten there.
That was what the semantic web was supposed to be about, but it didn't take off. Yeah.
Because you need a central body that's managing it. I mean, it's not something that can come organically. You need so many people to agree.
Yeah.
You actually have to have a standards body or a company like Apple to say, this is what we're going to track and this is the format that it's going to be in.
And I think Apple is the perfectly positioned company, possibly one of the only ones that could really pull it off on a wide scale. Because, I mean, can you imagine if Samsung tried to do this and say, we're going to create the standard, like just
no,
they don't have the cloud. No. They just don't have the cloud and the trust to do that.
No. Even Google, Google has their initiatives, but they're focusing on kind of weird pie in the sky things. Like Apple,
Have the devices. The reason why Apple can do it is because
they have the hardware.
Doctors already have iPads.
Yeah.
And all these research places have iPads.
And there's a ton of connected medical devices that support the iPad or the iPhone. Like there's blood pressure cuffs and oximeters that all work with iPad now. So, yeah, it's really easy to integrate. And this is why the reason Apple is going after this so hard and the reason why they've hired all these people and the reason why the Apple Watch is so focused on health is probably primarily due to Tim Cook and Steve Jobs, probably more Steve Jobs. I think in the Steve Jobs biography, it talked about while he was sick and in the hospital and instead of resting, he was busy talking about how shitty everything in the hospital was and how he would improve it and make it better.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that he probably would have had conversations with Tim Cook about that stuff. And it probably drove them to put part of the company into focusing on improving health.
Well, it would have been top of mind. I mean, when you've had experience with cancer, your health would be top of mind all the time.
Exactly. So I think moving forward, the two primary focuses of Apple are going to be health and education.
So knowing what you know of Apple and, I mean, their entire ecosystem and how each thing that they build becomes part of that platform, right? I mean, why are they making a car?
Huh. Well,
do we really want to go down that route
fit?
Right now?
Huh?
I'm like, we got to leave some time to talk about Ghostbusters. I know. That's going to be like a half-hour discussion.
I think the reason they're looking at a car is because it's a big part of people's lives. Just like phones are, just like your house is, just like TV. But more fundamentally, your car is probably one of the most important devices in your life. It's the most important piece of hardware in your life because it gives you the freedom to go where you want to go, to do what you want to do. Without a car, you're basically walking or taking public transit, and then you're at the mercy of outside forces. But in a car, you're in control, and you go where you want. And so not only that, but existing car hardware is shit. It's utter shit.
Well, it's ripe for disruption. The whole industry and clearly, but if you remember
not, it's not just the hardware. It's not just the software running the cars. It's also the production methods.
Right.
Like, cars have been manufactured in the same way that they've been manufactured for almost 100 years. In fact, over 100 years now. When was the Model T constructed?
I don't know, early 1918,
yeah. Maybe. So almost 100 years, probably. Same production line model, same methods. Sure, it's become more automated now, but yeah. It's
replacing
still
people with machines.
Yeah, with articulated arm right. things that weld right. stuff
yeah,
perfectly.
But a lot of that has to do with safety and to do with the physical properties of building a, you know, gas combustion engine.
Sure.
So that leads you to a lot of, you know, direction as far as decision making.
Yeah. But of course, Apple doesn't think that way. Mm. Apple throws the rules out the yeah. window. So what could you do if you could build a car any way you wanted and it was fully electric? What would you do then?
This is
how
I
would
think,
you build
I think
it?
The car is such a perfect opportunity to not only redesign, but rethink the way we actually build and make the experience of being in a car, because
exactly.
this is to me very analogous to what happened pre-iPhone launch in 2007, you know, yeah. the famous story
exactly.
Where, you know, Steve walks into they all kind of like all the executives, Steve Jobs, Phil Schiller, they all throw their crappy BlackBerries with QWERTY keyboards onto the table. And they're like, all of these phones suck. This is all a terrible experience. If we were to actually build this ourselves, how would this look? How would it work? And this is totally what they're going to do with the car, too.
Oh, absolutely.
They probably been, it's, I mean, I can only imagine from a designer's perspective, they'd be like,
Johnny
kid,
Ive loves
a kid
cars,
in a candy
so
store.
This is
like such a
shit.
Yeah, it's like a great opportunity to rethink it, because not only like phones now are such a big part of our daily lives, but for so many people, not everyone, but for so many people, cars are a big part of their lives, whether yep. it's from getting from point A to point B in a commute to work, or to pick up their kids from school. And, you know, stories are exchanged, laughs are exchanged in a car. You listen to music. Like, it's like your second home for a lot
I
of people.
I think you're selling this better than I am.
Yeah, no,
that's
I need
exactly
to buy a car.
It. Like, that is exactly it. A car is your second home.
And I think for a lot of people, especially people, designers that are already in the car industry, their ability to think creatively is somewhat limited. I mean, a lot of people yeah. are so limited by, you know, designing within the bounds of what we've always come to expect. And Apple has been, I mean, like the example with the phones,
yeah.
been able to say, like to come out with something that's not iterative.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, like where basically they say, like you said, all these things are wrong.
Yeah. Well, and it's if like you had never seen a car before, yeah. how would you make a car?
Yeah. Right. Well, it's like you're saying, Matt, about iterative design. It's like every time I'm always waiting year after year for some manufacturer to come out with a car that actually genuinely does something truly interesting with the interior design. And I haven't seen it. It's like Mazda, Toyota, Lexus, Nissan, all of these guys, all they seem to do every year is just make these incremental interior
very
changes.
Very superficial changes.
Very superficial. Yeah. Oh, let's put a bigger LCD screen, because having a larger screen is what everybody wants. And
yeah,
that's just
totally.
Going to be like, it's like, no, I don't just want a bigger screen with it.
You know what the Apple car is
going to
be?
Interface.
You know what the Apple car is going to be?
What?
Holographic HUD in the windshield and Siri. That's it.
Like Jarvis.
I
some Tony
don't
Stark
agree.
Stuff.
I mean,
well, Corvettes have a heads up display already for like attack yeah. and speedometer and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
but there's some controversy around that.
Being a distracting.
Yeah,
thing?
Like there's not every place is on board with. Although, I mean, this is how they were with radios initially, where they
right.
said it was way too distracting.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And right now they're like, well, maybe it's too distracting for people to. I think it's a lot less distracting because you don't have to look down.
Exactly.
Right.
Sure. It's right there in your field of vision as you're driving.
Yeah. I actually got into a bad car crash once because I actually reached down, looked down to actually put a CD in, and I was like fiddling around with buttons and rear-ended someone pretty bad. That was a mistake I never made again.
So, I mean, if it's thrown up in your field of vision,
yeah.
And for example, let's say you ask for directions. What if the direction path was actually overlaid as an augmented reality thing right on the windshield?
That's totally what
arrows
it should.
That show you where that's you need to go.
That's what it should be.
Well, like,
exactly.
When I always thought it would go in here. Whenever you see with the TED Talk or any of the presentations that Google's done where they say this is what the car sees, and then I'm like, well, I want to see that. I want to see what the car sees. Like, when they show, like, they have someone who is not visually in view. A pedestrian.
Yeah, the cyclist.
Who's going to like...
Through the shrub.
Right,
yeah.
Who's going to actually cross in front of the car. And they have... And it's plotted out the likely course that person is going to take.
Yep.
And it's like, well, then show me that. I want to see that on my screen. Like, what's actually going to happen?
Because that view, what the car sees, is clearly so far... advanced and superior than what the human eyes can
exactly.
see.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what you
it
should
be seeing.
It can
highlight the lines in the road.
Honestly, like... I think Google's going about it all wrong. They're focusing on, we have to improve this shit so much that we can make it self-driving. But why not start simpler? Why not start, use these sensors to augment the driver's ability to drive?
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, that's what Apple Car 1.0 is going to look like.
I don't think we're that far off from I mean, that technology does not seem that far away.
Right now, the tech is good enough to be able to augment existing drivers.
Right.
Like, you would be able to mount it. Right now, it's pretty ugly, but I'm sure Apple would be able to find a way to miniaturize it and make it really sleek and awesome.
I don't know how it works, but having the actual heads-up display, is it like a layer between the glass?
Yeah, or? It would be a transparent... TFT substrate.
It ends up looking like it's in front of the car, right?
Yes.
So that, I mean, that's the effect it has.
It would likely be a similar technology to the way Microsoft HoloLens works.
Mm-hmm. Like almost as if you had a projector projecting it onto the
road. It would look like that.
Yeah,
it would look like what I would love to have is say it's, you know, pouring down rain and then basically you have a lit up lines alongside the road that you normally wouldn't be able to see.
Yeah, because
at night,
right.
It would basically give you night vision. It would give you ghost outlines of things in the road.
Right.
And yeah.
Right, like Terminator 2 style, like, you know, where it's actually like outlining things.
Well, there have been so many scenarios where I wish something like that existed because there are certain stretches just down here too around Mohit Highway that are so poorly lit on like in pitch black darkness with rain coming down. And once that rain hits the road, it's like you cannot see. And half the times, like the divide between the different lanes, the paint isn't even fresh.
Yeah.
So it's faded and you can't even see. Like, it's really dangerous. And that is something that would fix that problem.
Yeah. And I mean, this tech exists now. They're just... laser focused, almost myopically so, on improving it and improving it so that self-driving cars can work.
Wouldn't it create a significant enough additional cost, though, to the car to have something like that?
They already have the data.
Like,
the tech is literally just like radar and sonar stuff that's been around for 50 years.
Sure. And there's a computer that's computing it, you know, and the processing, it's doing a lot of processing.
Right.
But I mean,
cut that part out, like the part that's self-driving is that heuristic processing of the incoming input.
Right.
But if you just display the input, there's no overhead.
But you realize all the self-driving part of it is taking what is the car's likely path, so in order to be able to do that, it has to calculate everyone else's likely path in order to say what the car's path should be, like in relation to that. And then, all you're taking out is the car's path.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could still give you like projected in front of you. This is the path that you should take.
Like in Grand Theft Auto.
Sure. And as far as like, you know, they're looking myopically, I mean, there are reasons for that. And I think we could probably expand on that in a different. Because yeah, lots of good reasons to jump straight there.
There are very good reasons to replace drivers with machines that can react faster, and et cetera.
The way I see with the augmented reality stuff, the way I see this happening at first, I think, is that it's going to be an additional cost on cars that you should be able to buy it as an option, just like you can buy like a grand touring package or something on any car that you would get that. But I can't see them including that on the cheapest of cheap cars where
it'll be on the Apple Car by default.
Okay, fine.
And then
it'll be
everyone else.
It should be an add-on.
But everyone else. This stuff should be in every car though.
It should be. But Apple's probably going to be the first to do it. And then all the other car manufacturers, all the other car manufacturers will realize, oh shit, we have to do this too. Yeah.
And then Samsung will make their shitty knockoff. They have the
Hyundai
running.
Wait,
running
is Hyundai a Korean brand? Is
What's
Hyundai?
That?
I think. I think
yeah, maybe.
It is.
Yeah. So they'll partner with Hyundai, and it'll be
Michael, the last thing I want on a heads-up display in my car is TouchWiz.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
With their candy-colored icons.
What is TouchWiz?
TouchWiz is the UI that they put on top of Android.
It's the skin on top of Android.
Specifically for Samsung?
It makes it worse. Much, much worse.
With the dumbest name imaginable.
TouchWiz.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about...
Yeah. Yes. You want to talk about Ghostbusters?
Let's talk about Ghostbusters.
So the international trailer was recently released, although it is very short. I've watched both the regular trailer and the international trailer. Let's just start with Michael and then get your input, Matt, because I have my own comments about this, but I wanted to get your thoughts about how you feel about Ghostbusters being revitalized, some of your thoughts as to what's going to play out in the story, whether or not they're going to acknowledge the pre-existing universe of the Ghostbusters, or if they're going somewhere else entirely different that maybe we're not anticipating. So how do you feel about that? And I also, so we don't forget too, I definitely want to talk about some of the negativity, maybe a lot of the negativity happening, because I've seen countless YouTube videos from people that have just been absolutely shitting on this, saying it's going to be the worst, the trailer sucks. I don't feel the same way as these people. I feel they're being overly negative, especially just prejudging a movie before it's even out. But how do you feel about it?
I think it looks good, but I'm also a little bit apprehensive. I mean, so many films are made that are reboots or redos, and they end up not being as good as the original, but there are those that are better than the original or just as good. But I think a lot of the time it ends up being that it didn't need to be made. But I think in
Total Recall, for example.
Yeah, Total Recall.
I still haven't seen the reboot.
Do not.
I had no interest in that.
But I think in this case, I think it works just because... the original Ghostbusters was basically, we're bringing these comedians together, we're telling this awesome, fun story, and we're just going to let it play out. And that's what they're doing here. And they happen to be women, but that doesn't matter. And if anything, it's refreshing to see a team of women kick ass and save the world.
From what I've heard, I think it was the director, and I always forget his name. What's his name?
Paul Feig,
okay. And he was saying that they set out to create characters that were not going to necessarily be direct comparisons to, or direct, what's the right word? They're not...
Clones.
They're not clones of the original characters. They're not, they're not female variants.
They're not it's not like Lady Egon.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So they set out to, and admirably so, set out to create something a little more original, which is good. But from what I saw in the trailer, it seems like they're not acknowledging the existence of the Ghostbusters, because they even say in the trailer that, oh, we need to create this tech in order to fight, to basically destroy these ghosts. So it's like, it made me think, well, the tech already exists. There was a previous Ghostbusters team. So are they not acknowledging it? Or is there something that we're not?
I think they've said there will be Easter eggs. We already know that Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver have cameos, but not as the characters as they characters. Portrayed.
Well, and there's a few other tip-offs that basically say the events of the first films didn't happen in this film universe. Like there's the logo that Chris Hemsworth draws. So it's, I mean, if the previous Ghostbusters had existed,
right,
then they would have the building with the logo. And then the other part of it is the hearse. You know, it's
different.
Well, it's different, but it's also a reference to the original.
Sure.
But it makes it clear that it's like they're encountering that type of car for the first time as far as using it as a Ghostbusters vehicle.
And their headquarters seems to be a Chinese restaurant as well.
But it looks pretty similar.
The firehouse doesn't exist in this?
They showed the firehouse for a brief frame. It might be where they end up at the end of the first film. I don't know. But
it sounded like before we were recording, Michael, you had a pretty wacky, far out theory about this.
I have my insane theory.
Okay, let's hear.
Which is probably not true. But in the trailer, you will notice a scene where a bunch of ghosts are congregated in Times Square, and a ripple of ghost energy kind of comes down like a curtain. And what was 2016 Times Square billboards are replaced with 1970-something billboards. So ads for regular movies and things are suddenly replaced with a giant billboard for Taxi Driver and neon signs and a bunch of other stuff.
That's a very interesting catch, because I didn't notice that the first time I saw it.
It's blink and you'll miss it,
yeah,
but it's there and it's very obvious if you're paying attention.
So maybe there's more going on with this.
Exactly. So, and it's not like ghost billboards or anything. It's like reality is literally being altered,
like rewritten,
to the point where Times Square is suddenly its 1970s counterpart. Like they've gone back in time somehow.
Okay, so this is essentially, they stole the Star Trek reboot plot.
Maybe?
Where something happened and someone went back in time. It's just that it's a ghost time traveler.
I guess.
Except that there's no search for whales in this.
Yes. So my theory is the original Ghostbusters got sealed in a ghost dimension that's stuck in the 1970s. And no one can remember them, at least consciously. And these women, they get together, and at a subconscious level, they remember the Ghostbusters from when they were kids, and it drives them to study the paranormal, and they end up developing the exact same things because they kind of half remember it, which is why it's exactly the same stuff, more or less.
This is like those fan theories about when they say that, like,
all I'm going to say is
all
I
the
know.
Characters in Harry Potter were really characters from the Smurfs.
All I'm going to say is hashtag rejected scripts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insane.
No, actually, that sounds plausible. Like that could very well be what's happening here.
I mean, something weird is definitely going on. There's something happening.
Something
with time.
Strange in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They may need to call somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. We might need to. I mean, something is definitely happening with time.
Well,
and
why, if they really wanted
but
to
they
make
have
something,
Slimer.
I was going to say that that's where I'm going with this is that
Slimer.
If they really wanted to make something that is absolutely not connected with the original material, why include all of these ghosts that existed in the original, like Slimer?
There are a bunch of ghosts that didn't though. Like,
yeah, there are a bunch
in
of
the
new
international
ones.
Trailer. There's that phantom that looks like a dragon that comes out of the DJ.
Yeah. There's no Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, at least not
no.
that we see.
Well, they got that one from Scott Pilgrim.
There is also a giant stilt-walking ghost as well.
Yeah.
And then there's like a theater full of 1930s ghosts. And yeah, it's very odd.
I just want to know if there's going to be Zool.
Probably not.
Oh, man.
Are you a god? Then die.
Ray. When someone asks if you are a god, you say yes. Oh, Ghostbusters.
Hey, did either of you, just as an aside, did either of you read Ernie Hudson's heartbreaking story about what happened with the original screenplay of his character? He had a much more substantial role in that movie, and he was his character was in at the beginning of the movie, which would have totally changed him into a more integral character.
He was written as a scientist and also an ex-Marine, I think.
Right, right. Ex-Air Force.
Oh, right, yeah. So he was going to have a much larger role, and then they kind of turned him into the everyman. But at the same time, I understand the reason for the change. Like, he basically became the voice of the audience.
Yeah, he was also the skeptic sort of coming in. Yeah,
like, he came in and it's like, what the hell are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Like, and so he was... Really, he should have come in at the beginning because then he would have been there for them doing all this stuff. And the whole time he would have been like, the hell are you doing? Like, basically, the voice of the audience.
Yeah, because the three of them were all crazy.
Yeah.
Like, in the original story, like, they each were, like, completely nuts.
They were nuts and incompetent, and they got thrown out of the university.
Yeah.
And somehow they had plutonium to make the proton packs. Libyans, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe they know Doc Brown.
But what I noticed...
They weren't nuts. They were eccentric.
Right.
They were pretty nuts. But what I noticed is that even though that was written out, after I read that story, and then I watched the trailer again, and it says right at the beginning, 30 years ago, four scientists. Like, so it's making a reference. It calls them all scientists from the first movie, even though the first movie never said he was a scientist.
Yeah.
So...
Though, in the international trailer, it says four friends.
Well.
So.
Maybe that's just whoever. I mean, sometimes the people who make the trailer have no direct connection.
You know what I really liked? I really liked it was really cool seeing the modern CGI effects for the Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Like the proton pack.
The proton packs look like they're firing lightsabers at the
ghosts.
Yeah,
it was really great.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they actually look substantial instead of, you know, the animated
lines. Yeah. Painted on.
Like, it's like molten light is being shot out of those things.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and some people didn't like the CG ghosts, but I even they were more substantial rather than like these.
No, they look better for sure.
Yeah.
They also looked, even though they were translucent, they were simultaneously translucent but also seemed to have some layer of depth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were more substantial. That's
exactly.
What I mean. Yeah.
Exactly. So at the very least, even if this movie somehow turns out to not be good, from a technical standpoint, it'll look really good.
Yeah.
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 And as far as getting back to your original question, as far as will it be good? When I saw the trailer, I got to say I was a little disappointed it didn't look as funny as I had hoped. I mean, like, with the amount of talent that's there.
Yeah.
Why spoil it? Why throw in all the jokes in it and ruin the trailer?
Right. And which is the other mistake that people do. But
the original trailers for the first Ghostbuster movie were terrible.
Well, trailers back then were terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't really get the idea at first. But it was, I don't know. It just seemed kind of weak writing and... I don't know. So I'm still hopeful, and I'll probably see it.
Does anyone know who wrote the screenplay for this movie? Was it co-written by more than one person?
Wasn't the director one of the writers?
I think so,
Because he wrote Bridesmaids, didn't he?
Yep.
So I'm pretty sure he was involved in the writing of this one. And I will say, the other thing, there are people who made more of a stink about it than I really wanted to, but I was disappointed with, how they introduced Leslie Jones, is that her name, the actress, into the movie? Where it was like...
It's kind of problematic.
It was just the way they staged the trailer, which was like, there's comments to each other like, we're all smart. And then she comes in.
The city.
I know the streets. I'm street smart.
Whoa, hold on. This is odd. I don't know if you guys.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. So it's written by Paul Feig, Dan Aykroyd, Ivan Reitman.
Do you guys realize how many cameos are confirmed in here? Listen to this.
Everybody?
Bill Murray, Sigourney Weaver, Dan Aykroyd, Annie Potts.
Oh, yeah, the original secretary.
Oh, wow.
This is Ernie Hudson is also listed officially.
Huh.
So this means that this might be really interesting.
Okay, so it looks like the credits for Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis, and even Reitman are just like based on the film Ghostbusters. It was co-written by Paul Feig and Katie Dippold, who was a writer on Parks and Rec.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you want to comment on my comment?
But yeah. I think they're trying to do the whole everyman thing, but I think the trailer did a bad job of showing that off.
And maybe if we're lucky, this will be one of those movies, like possibly like what Simon Pegg was saying for Star Trek Beyond, where it's like, look, guys, they screwed up the trailer. The trailer is really a poor reflection of what this movie will actually be like. So maybe
it's
the
possible.
Ghostbusters movie will surprise
I've heard,
us.
I've heard that because she sits in that booth all day as an MTA worker, she reads a lot. So it's not just I know the streets, but she literally knows the history of New York. And like, so when they're encountering all this ghost shit, she actually knows, like, back in the 20s when this was a theater, this shit went down and things like that.
What was this?
Let's hope.
Really apocryphal knowledge.
What was disappointing to me is seeing people on Twitter draw all these conclusions and assumptions about her being the sassy black woman who's also uneducated. I'm like, where are you getting uneducated from? Like, there's nothing
there,
because she talks like that doesn't mean she's uneducated.
There are physicists that can't find a job that are working at McDonald's. So, I mean, how do you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's what really pissed me off.
Yeah.
You just can't draw. Because of someone's accent.
From one trailer, you can't
really
assume.
That's like saying all people with a southern accent are, like, inbred. I mean, that's just dumb.
Yeah. Well, to phrase the criticism like that opens the criticism up to criticism, but I think in the way that the trailer was presented, it did. They have that character say, "You're all smart, but I know the street, the city," or something
yeah.
like that. Doesn't she say something?
She says something like
something
that,
like
yeah.
that. So she does, even in the dialogue, set herself apart as not being as smart, as academic as them. I mean, yeah. She says she qualifies it and says that she has. So I don't think it's worthy of the amount of outrage that's piled on that, like most things on the internet. But you know, just for me, before I saw, you know, anyone else's reactions, I was personally disappointed. I was like, you know, I mean, there's, it's just.
Yeah. In what way though, were you disappointed specifically?
Because it wasn't creative.
Yeah.
Like it was like, I mean, it just played directly into our stereotypes.
Yeah,
and
true.
Maybe hopefully the film will break that in some way.
Yeah.
But it's just,
well, yeah,
of all the choices you could have made, it was just like all along, you know, it was almost like along every cliche as far as, you know, as far as how you cast, you know, people of color in
yeah.
a film and then how you cast, you know, in contrast, the three white women
yeah.
In the film. And, you know, and I know that Paul Feig. I mean, he responded to that criticism and he you know, said basically something along the lines of, you know, we can't sort of solve every societal problem at once. You know, we've started with, you know, a cast of four strong women. And I think that's valid too. It's just, so that's why to give him that was the reason why I wasn't like, well, this is, you know, total bullshit that you would ever, you know, write a black woman this way. It's just, but I was still, I was disappointed with the way that was, at least the way it was presented why couldn't they, you know, I don't know. Like, why couldn't they have all known each other, or why couldn't, you know, she been one of the main three before? It's just,
yeah. Apparently, originally Melissa McCarthy was going to play that role, but they decided that they didn't want her to play that kind of loud mouth role that, because she always plays that. And I find she's a better actress when she does something more low key, like in Spy.
Yeah,
she was really good in that.
Yeah.
So I think they did a similar thing here.
So maybe it was just sort of like an accidental like side effect of that choice.
Yeah, I think it might have been. But
especially if the role was actually written for Melissa McCarthy, then it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I think those are all fair complaints. Again, you have to be careful. I think even as a fan, more so, to not draw conclusions and prejudge. And I think it's really hard to, as a fan and as a nerd of like Ghostbusters, that you so want it to be good, but then all these fears come to mind, and then sort of. You know, you can really easily get wrapped up in that and start picking it apart before you haven't even seen it.
And then, of course, there is valid criticism there, but we only have like a minute of footage.
Yeah.
So
well, I personally hope it succeeds. Like, I mean, I think a lot of fans, when they have their sacred cow, whatever it is, and they see someone who's touching that material.
Especially if there's sexism there. Yeah,
especially if there's sexism, will immediately react with, no, this shouldn't happen.
You can't put women in Ghostbusters.
But I never had that reaction. Like,
well, there was a lot of that, though.
Oh, yeah,
when they
so
first
much.
All female cast, so you can't,
much. When
you
they
can't
first
do
announced
that.
It, it right. was terrible.
Right, but like, I don't, I mean, like, as a geek, as a, you know, film nerd, I don't treat it like, you know, all those things are sacred and you can never, I mean, there's always a new angle that you can do on it. I mean, if it's good writing, it's good writing. And like,
yeah.
Yeah. What does it matter?
And they're all funny comedians. And like Kate McKinnon is amazing.
Yeah.
And
I was super
Kristen
excited.
Wiig is amazing.
I mean, yeah, even despite, you know, the criticisms that I have that may turn out to be unfounded. I still want it to work. I want it to succeed. I mean, yeah. I'd love it if there was more than one film, you know, with the four of them, because I think it's promising the way that they've set it up.
And I think it opens up all the world of Ghostbusters to a whole new generation who didn't grow up with the originals.
Exactly. And the merchandising.
Well, and what's cool about Ghostbusters as a story, I mean, I don't know if you've ever thought about it very much, but it's different from every other action film, and that your action stars are four like eccentric nerds, essentially. I mean, debatable as far as Ernie Hudson character, but like, but essentially it's a movie about nerds who become action heroes. And
because their cleverness allows them to
just
build
from their brains
hardware.
That's right.
And allows them to fight ghosts.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, and you don't usually see that, and I think that's, I mean, for me personally, I think that's why the film was so exciting to me growing up, is because like it seemed like, oh, you know, I could do that.
Yeah.
I mean, and, not to fight ghosts specifically, but I could identify with the characters.
One thing I think this movie gets right over the original, we actually get to see them building the stuff.
Right.
Like in the original, it was just, oh, the prototypes, like they had already built them and they were ready to go.
Egon had built them or something like that?
Like they were just there.
Yeah, I hope we get to see a little bit
more. The hotel was their first
that.
Trial run of them.
Right. They didn't know how they were going to work. I mean, but that angle was kind of exciting too, because it was like the, you know, eccentric, you know, nerd had suddenly
they
just
might
built
explode
something.
Don't cross the streams, like,
and he was like, we may all die if we actually use these.
I mean, that angle was great, but it was like they were already there, like it was already a part of the world, and we didn't get to see like how they kind of like their thought process, how they were like, okay, ghosts are real, so then how do we catch them?
Yeah.
Or like, do we need to catch them? Like, and this film looks like it's going to actually go through those steps.
Yeah.
So we're going to have them finding a ghost. I guess that scene in the library with the one that barfs on Kristen Wiig. And then they go back and it's like, well, these ghosts are a problem. What are we going to do about it? And then it's like, okay, let's get to work.
Yeah. Even the original, like the foot thing where they capture, like it didn't, we just sort of went along with it. It doesn't really explain where the hell that came. Like how they doesn't explain
the
how they knew.
Came out of nowhere. And then suddenly like they were in the firehouse and then they had this laser containment grid and it's like, what is that?
So we're running out of time here, maybe five more minutes. So we should probably wrap, but any other closing comments? I know there's one thing that I wanted to pick your brain about, which is hypothetically, if this movie is successful, and I'm sure if it is successful, we'll see additional movies with this new cast, but let's talk merchandise, because we know Ghost merchandise was always a big thing with the original series. There was a short-lived cartoon series. There were toys.
I love the cartoon.
Because what happens with the merchandise if this is going to have obviously because they have an all-female cast, are they going to make action figures with the characters?
Yes, they are.
Are they going to be targeted?
Paul Feig actually posted a picture on Instagram of their action figures, now, or like an early prototype.
Was it in a pink box?
Where are those toys going to go? In what aisle? Girls' aisle or the boys'
that's
aisle?
That's the question, isn't it?
If they're smart, they'll put the toys in both the girls' and the boy aisle.
If they're smart, they'll or stop neither. Having aisles.
Yeah,
that's I've well, long
let's neither gender. Aisle.
I've
let's
long
just
argued
have
for
the
that.
Toy aisle.
Yeah, like the action figure aisle.
It's
yeah.
so dumb.
Exactly.
When you walk into Toys R Us, they still have blue aisle boys, pink aisle.
Yeah,
it's like come on.
But a lot of that segregation is more recent, even like
yeah.
Like
you know what that weird thing is that it's not just toy companies that have. Toy companies started
there's so
this.
Much that's gendered. Like,
but parents have pushed
razors.
This. Parents...
Razors are gendered. Deodorant yeah, is gendered.
Pink razors are for girls.
It's fucking absurd.
It's like, is the metal different somehow?
Even better, like, they had just, there was just a news story about this. The female gendered items cost more than the male ones.
And sometimes they're identical. The actual product is identical,
Exactly.
They'll charge.
You know, just slap a pink label on it and charge $3 more.
And Lady Speed Stick is
Nerf actually released. They have two versions.
Oh God,
Nerf has two versions of a crossbow.
The
right?
Rebel.
The one for girls is exactly the same, except it has a pink paint job and pink packaging.
And I think it has hearts on it too.
Maybe.
And
it's a crossbow, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Like, they're trying to capture the whole Katniss thing. Did Katniss have a fucking Cupid heart bow? I don't think so. She had a compound bow that she murdered people with.
Keep it clean, Michael.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, we could talk another hour about gender stereotyping. I mean, even if you walk into a toy store now, you still see, like, both on the girls' end and the boys' end, like, you know, I was in a Toys R Us not too long ago, and you go in there, and they still have, like, you can buy, like, you know, a tool kit for a kid.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And it's like, because, you know, every boy is a handyman, right?
Yeah.
Like, does every, like, the, you could buy, like a toy chainsaw and tool kit. I'm like, why?
Yeah.
And with girls, too, they sell, like, you can buy a little kitchenette set.
It was actually like when I was growing up, I mean, not to go too far into my own childhood, but
let's go down that rabbit hole.
When I was a child, because I grew up in a pacifist family, we couldn't have anything that was war related.
Yeah.
And
no cops and robbers for you then.
Well, I wanted, you know, people, but you couldn't actually, the only people you could get were like G.I. Joe and He-Man. And so for the boys, there was no like action figures that weren't murderous in some way. Like,
yeah.
And so like all the girls had like, you know, different, just like regular people.
Mm.
And then the boys didn't like, I couldn't actually play with anyone that was, you know, represented a person. And so, I don't know. That was one of the problems that I encountered growing up, is I never got to actually play with a male doll of some kind.
Well, and
what I mean is they didn't exist.
Yeah, and that goes back to the gendering. Like, male-gendered toys, it's not just that they're for boys. It's also, like, toxic masculinity. It's all, let's kill and
violent.
Maim and be badasses. Like, tough, you know?
It's not all toxic, but I mean, like, but it is all, a lot of it is derived from, like, war and, you know, violence, but anyway.
And on that note.
Let's solve that some other day.
Yeah. Hopefully the Ghostbusters toys will be in a separate aisle that is neither gender. Proton packs for all.
If they release a pink firehouse toy,
a pink Ecto-1.
I'm going to lose it. I'm going to lose it.
Goodbye, world.
Burn it down. All right.
Yeah.
That's wrapped. You've been listening to the Impromptu on Hologram Radio. I'm joined by Michael Norton, as always, and today we have Matthew Dean. And Matthew, this is your chance to plug anything. You're on Twitter, right?
I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MatthewDieners. And if I'm going to plug anything, I'll plug Crunch too. Again, go to getcrunch.co. And if you're, especially if you're a web developer, or you can go to twitter.com/getcrunch, or you can go to facebook.com/getcrunch.
All right, that's enough.
Or you can go to Insta. No.
Well, if you'd like to support the Impromptu, there are a few ways that you can do that. We have a new Patreon page set up at patreon.com/hologramradio. Donate a buck or two, whatever you feel comfortable with, which helps us immensely cover our operational costs to run our servers, to run our hosting, and all that sort of stuff. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or whatever podcast player of choice you prefer. But if you are in iTunes, why not also drop us a comment or a 5-star rating? And that is actually one of the best ways to help us and help new people discover our show. You can also support us by going to our hologramradio.org/sponsors page. And on our sponsors page, you'll find links to our Amazon UK, USA, and Canada links. And of course, all of us like to shop on Amazon these days. And why not just click on one of those links? There's no additional work needed on your part. And every time you buy something, it will send us a small commission. You can follow us on Twitter, starting with the @TheImpromptu, and individually, we're @ZenImpulse for Michael Norton and @ZeroDistraction for myself, and of course, Matthew Dieners as well, if you want to follow him. We're on Instagram as well, @HologramRadioShows, Hologram Radio on Twitter, if you want to check out all the other great shows on the network. And you can also follow the Impromptu on Twitter if you want to keep up to date on when we post new episodes, which go out every Saturday. If you'd like to send us a comment, either positive or negative, you can email the Impromptu at hologramradio.org, and that goes to both myself and Michael
Norton.
Is there another Michael present here that I don't know about?
It just seemed like there was a pause for a last name.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.